From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It can seem so, well, humorless trying to analyze humor. E.B. White said it was like dissecting frogs. Few people are interested, and the subject always dies in the end. The neuroscientist Scott Weems gets that. He's written a book about humor, so he knows he's on shaky ground. But he says the topic is absolutely worthy of our attention for a couple of reasons. Humor, he says, is about human connection. It's something we can share with others. And he says humor is the result of this complex process going on in our brains, which involves conflict and compromise, and a laugh is the sign we may have figured it out. Today in the program, Scott Weems is joining us to talk about the science of when and why we laugh. The book is called Ha! After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The neuroscientist Scott Weems says if you're going to understand how humor works, you know, why we laugh at the stuff we do, then you've got to recognize what's going on in the human brain. Weems says, think of your brain like the Reagan presidency. You've got all these different interests, all acting independently with only the semblance of a chief executive. And that's a funny line, but he means it. The brain lets all these different ideas, sometimes conflicting ideas, compete. We work it out and work it out, and when we figured it out, we laugh. Weems has written a book where he explains the science of when and why we laugh. It's called Ha! And he's joining us today in the program. Weems is a research scientist at the University of Maryland's Center for Advanced Study of Languages. He joined us from a studio in Little Rock, Arkansas, where he lives. So I want to begin with February 4th, 1961, because you mark this as the beginning of, as you say, the prolonged death of the kind of the traditional joke. This was, we should point out, February 4th, 1961, this is Lenny Bruce's performance at Carnegie Hall, what has come to be known as his kind of master performance. Let's start with that, February 4th, 1961. Set this up for us, this moment.
Sure, yeah. This was, as you said, it was Lenny Bruce's finest moment in a way. He had been doing stand-up for quite a while, but this was one of his first big gigs, and it was held in the middle of a huge snowstorm in New York. So the city was essentially shut down. He was just barely able to make it. He had to take a very roundabout way of getting even to the city himself. So it was at midnight and snowy night, dark and stormy night, as they say, and he was worried no one would show up, and instead everybody showed up. And it wound up defining his career, I suppose.
We have a clip from that evening. I wanted to play it. And we should point out, as you do in the book, Bruce didn't tell conventional jokes. These were observations. It was an act that had little structure. There wasn't, you know, set up punchline. It was more personal than that. Here's a clip.
Doesn't make you hip or square or highly intellectual or lacking intellectual capacity if you don't understand a joke. Because if you haven't been exposed to it, what the guy? Okay, I'll show you a classic example. Joke. Not joke. Funny joke. Like Kennedy cannot make the acceptance speech. He's got a virus, and they got about a half hour to go, and they're just flipping out. Sorry. I know a guy in Boston who's a ringer for him. Paul, get him here right away. And the only trouble is he's a burlesque comic. He works real toilets. And yeah. All right, get him anyway. Dress him up. Now, the guy is frightening to put him. He's a real ringer, you know. Does he drink? No, it's a little speech. He'll memorize it, and that's all. Can we trust him? We'll kill him right after the show, man. That's all right. That's all right. Make it. So there are six real heavyweights are holding their breath there, you know. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. Thank you, Ambassador. Before I introduce my cabinet members, I'd like to... I'd like to give you my impression of Clyde McCoy. Funny, right? Funny. No. Only funny If you have been exposed to that many toilet comics and Al Jolson.
What I love about it is it gives you a sense of that evening, that he was all over the place. You heard the mic noise. He's barely finishing sentences. But as you say, this is his master performance, the thing that defines him. Talk about why it was, because the fluidity is something you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, he almost says it himself about humor being kind of like jazz. Yeah. I mean, this was early 60s, so we're talking jazz was all over the place too. And that's what his act was, essentially was. I mean, musicians don't practice individual notes. You know, you'd never have a trumpet player work on G today and then A the next day. They work on all the notes in combination and in creative ways. And that's essentially what Bruce was doing. He was just throwing out riffs here and there, sometimes connected, sometimes not, a lot like a musician might. And it sometimes doesn't make sense when you just take, you know, 30 seconds out of context. But when you listen to it on the whole, you get what he's doing, that he's essentially riffing on everything that comes to mind. And if you get in the same state of mind as him, I don't know if that's possible, then you get it, or to word it as he did, then you dig it.
Yeah. Explain why this is an important way of understanding humor. This is why you begin, how you begin the book. The audience is witnessing a new form of comedy. That's what happened that night.
Yeah. I mean, it shows how humor is a lot more than just jokes. A lot of times when we think of humor, we think of knock-knock jokes or chickens crossing the road. But that's not what humor really is. It's a psychological process. That's how I look at it. It's really how we deal with confusion, ambiguity, conflict, all of these things that make life complex but also enjoyable. And so while Bruce really maybe only had one traditional joke in his whole performance that night, he made people laugh the whole evening long. Because there was a connection there. There was a social connection that he was making with his audience. And you get that whenever we laugh. We're making a connection with people. And I think that's much more interesting and important than a knock-knock joke.
I suppose we should point out your goal in writing this book, you say, is not to be funny. In fact, you say this in the book. You say, "I think our overwhelming desire to be funny is the largest impediment to humor research." Explain what you mean.
It is. I mean, there's a difference between being funny and being entertaining. I didn't want to write a joke book. I mean, I didn't want to just tell jokes because that's not interesting. It doesn't really tell us anything new about how we think or telling us anything new about ourselves. I mean, it might be fun, and I love joke books. I read them all the time. Yeah. But what's more interesting is just understanding how humor works, and it's a little bit serious. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean it can't be fun, engaging, just exciting to learn how humor works. And there's a great line. It's by Victor Raskin, who is the editor of the premier humor academic journal. And he said, "Schizophrenia researchers don't try and sound delusional when describing that condition. Mm. So why should humor researchers really need to crack a joke or be funny?" So I hopefully the book is and the topic is fun, engaging, and it gets people as excited about it as I am. But I'm not just out there to tell jokes.
You say that this isn't just about humor isn't just about modern taste. It's not something that necessarily evolves, but it's about the needs of an audience. Now, we're going to break this down as we go, but give me a sense of what you mean by that, the needs of an audience. That was an interesting turn of phrase there.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting back to the idea of humor being really a process versus an outcome. So much of our lives are hard to interpret. I mean, I try and think about cases. Another thing I talk about early on is people who laugh at funerals or laugh at horror movies or sad movies. Mm. One of the things that drove me to write the book is when my wife broke out laughing at the end of Titanic, as Leonardo DiCaprio was drowning in the North Atlantic. I mean, a tragic scene, but she felt like James Cameron, the director, was just trying to pummel her with emotions, and she felt the need to rebel. And we do that all the time. We laugh when it's just socially unacceptable. And that's because we need to. I mean, we have a choice. We could either laugh or we could cry. And I believe a lot of times that it is a choice. And laughter is definitely the healthier mechanism to choose of those two.
The key idea in your book, or certainly one of them anyway, is that humor, in a kind of ironic-seeming way comes from conflict. It's this conflict going on in our brains.
It is. And I always hesitate a little bit when I use the word conflict because people think of that as a bad thing.
Yeah.
But it's good. Conflict is how we have diversity in our lives, how we're exposed to new ideas. If we're just thinking one way about a topic, that's not good. Life is much more complicated than that. So we're confronted with conflict every day whenever we're surprised by something. And our brains like surprises. It's healthy. It's an engaging thing. And so conflict isn't bad. Conflict is what keeps us engaged with the world.
How do we measure something that's funny? Because you say it's not just a matter of measuring laughter. I mean, that is one thing, and you do write a bit about the study of laughter. But how do we measure whether something is funny?
I think that question right there gets at the heart of humor research, because in some ways you can't. It's really difficult. I had scientists try and talk me out of writing this book, saying, no, you need to just study laughter. Laughter we can measure. This is concrete. And humor, that's vague. I don't know what to do with that. You should avoid that. And that's problematic, because just the fact that it's hard to understand doesn't mean we should ignore it. The simple answer is no, we can't measure it, but that's okay, because humor is not a formula or a concrete thing that is easily measured, you know, with numbers like 1, 2, or 5. You can come up with what is ostensibly the funniest joke in the world, but that's a subjective thing. It's much more complex than that, which really gets to the idea of reductionism in science. I'm not going to try and get too technical or too nerdy on this, but there's a way you can approach any science, is to try and break it down into the smallest component possible and understand that. That's kind of the way physics works a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But I think that's missing something. I think that there's something much more beautiful about complex phenomena like humor when you don't try and break it down to something smaller and you allow it to be big and complex and then understand it for all of that complexity that brings to it. So I don't think we can measure humor any more than we can measure language or intelligence or these other very high cognitive functions.
You say in the book that for a lot of human history, humor was pretty unpopular. Plato, you mentioned, he outlawed it in the Republic. The Bible, as you say in the book, downright aggressive about humor. talk a little bit about that. And I wonder if we've evolved since in terms of in our belief about humor. Let's start with history. Why? Why was it so unpopular, do you figure?
Sure. I mean, it's just the idea, I think, that humor is trivial.
Yeah.
Often we think of, this is just, it's just humor. It's not serious. I mean, there's a difference between being serious and being solemn. I'd say a lot in life is worth being serious about, but that doesn't mean we need to be solemn and sad or morose about these different things in our lives. And so, I always get a little bit of flack when I mention, like humor in the Bible, because there's a lot of interpretation to do there to say. But you can do things like measure laughter in the Old Testament and see that there's only 29 times that people laugh in the Old Testament, and all but two are not joy. They're the kind of laughter you don't want to hear, like in the second psalm where God is laughing at the kings of the earth with scorn. This is not good kind of laughter.
Yeah.
Nietzsche said that, man suffers so excruciatingly in life that he felt compelled to invent laughter, which I don't know if that's good or bad. I mean, it sounds so dark and depressing. And I think that's because we looked at humor for a long time that way as trivial and just maybe something that got us through the day. And I would argue that we're not that far from that now because, ask yourself this. When was the last time a comedy won Best Oscar?
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen. Annie Hall maybe in 1973, was that the year for it, I think?
Something like that, yeah.
It just doesn't happen. And even it was this is in my world what I consider a tragedy is I think it was 2007 maybe when The Hangover came out, and it did very well. It was the number one R movie I think of all time then. And that was also the year that they increased the number of Oscar nominations to 7 or 8 or some incredible number like that, and it didn't even get nominated. How could a movie that earned so much money and made so many people laugh it wasn't going to win, but at least it could be nominated? But no one was surprised that it wasn't. No one expected that. And that's a little bit of a shame. If it were easy to do, then Hangover 2 and 3 would have been funny.
Well, when you think about it, and as I said, we'll get to this as we go. But when you think about laughter and the way you write about it, that laughter in some way is this reaction that we have when we're trying to figure something out, a kind of a default reaction in terms of this conflict in our brains, or maybe a joyful reaction that we have figured it out. It makes you think about laughter in a different way.
It is. I mean, it's a process of discovery in a way. One of my favorite people, Richard Feynman, called the pleasure of his job the kick of the discovery, which means that he was a physicist and he won the Nobel Prize. But he said that the greatest part of his life wasn't winning prizes. It was the fact that he discovered new things each day. And that's what humor is. It's discovery just very fast, sometimes in the course of just a single joke or a single sentence. And we like that. We like discovery. We like to be engaged with the world. So if Groucho Marx throws out the line, you know, yesterday I shot an elephant to my pajamas, how it got in my pajamas, I'll never know. In the course of a sentence, you know, we come to a radical change of thinking, and it's, we enjoy that. It kind of shocks us in a good way.
Scott Weems, his book is called Ha, The Science of When We Laugh and Why. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the neuroscientist Scott Weems. We're talking about his book, Ha, The Science of When We Laugh and Why. Let's talk about, you get at this question of what is humor. And you mention, you go through these three particular case studies. You mentioned the one already about with your wife in the Titanic, this idea of laughing at something that seemed over the top and absurd, inappropriate almost to laugh at that moment. And maybe we'll come back to it, but let's start with your first case study, which I find really intriguing. This amazing story of this laughing epidemic in Tanzania. Tell this story.
This was, interestingly, not that far removed time-wise from Lenny Bruce's performance. Yeah. And it occurred in Tanzania. Then it was called Tanganyika. Yeah. I call it Bukoba because that's the general district of Africa. But it's a remote village. And a missionary school for girls, it started with three girls who just started laughing. They don't know why, and just they started laughing, as teenage girls sometimes do. And then their friends started laughing. And pretty soon it spread throughout the whole school, and they had to shut down the school because so many girls were laughing that they couldn't stop. It literally was an epidemic and forced the school to close, which was interesting because closing the school was the worst thing they could have done because that meant all the students went home to their villages and spread the laughing with them. So in the end, over a dozen schools were closed. 1,000 people were overcome with this. They called it laughing sickness. Just incredible. Lasted for a year and a half. And it's amazing that so many of us haven't heard of this before because I think it might be one of the strangest, if not the strangest, epidemic in history. And so trying to understand that is just an incredible challenge. You know, why would these girls laugh to the point where it wasn't fun anymore? It began to hurt. You know, try laughing for 2 or 3 hours, much less a week at a time, and it stops feeling good pretty fast. But I guess probably you'd like to know the conclusion, kind of what happened with it.
Well, I mean, it leaves us with this question, of course, as to why and what this tells us about humor, about it's, you know, whether it's contagious, what it says about our connection. What do you figure we learned about that?
Yeah, I think we can learn something from it, and it's that. Some people call it just a mass psychology, mass illness, just kind of they had a nervous breakdown. Yeah. But I think it's more complex than that because there's a reason they laughed. And if you look at the social change going on at that time, because they had just desegregated the schools. So what had typically been black or white classrooms now was desegregated. In addition to that, they had just switched from European to local rule. So they were no longer Europeans. They were true Africans. And on top of that, they were all pubescent girls just going through puberty and hitting that age where they're starting to date. And they had no idea who they were. Add to that new churches coming in the area and just new customs. And these girls were undergoing the most radical social and personal change you can put upon a person. And so they really kind of lost track on who they were. And so I think they began to laugh for the same reason like my wife laughed at Titanic, is that when you feel like you're overwhelmed and your brain doesn't know what to do with all of this change, you know, you can cry or you can laugh. And essentially that a whole country was overcome by a laughing sickness because they were – They didn't know what else to do. And eventually it died out about a year and a half later, but it took that long for them to get used to all the change.
The second laughter case study you write about comes from 2001, and this is just weeks after the attacks on 9/11. Take us through this story. This is this involves the comedian Gilbert Gottfried.
Yes, Gilbert Gottfried at the Hugh Hefner roast in New York. It was It's not a moment most people, you know, think about or hear about, but it occurred about 3 weeks after the terrorist tragedy of 9/11. And if those of us around remember, pretty much everything was shut down for a very long time. No one did comedy after the tragedy. TV shows just showed news and, you know, sporting events were canceled. Yeah. Things like Oscars were postponed. And so Gilbert Gottfried was one of a few comedians who were scheduled to go on that roast who had to figure out what do they perform? You know, how do you perform at an event like that after the tragedy? And so they did hold it, and the jokes were very safe. No one mentioned New York or Washington, D.C. or Pennsylvania, the crashes. And they stayed on safe topics. And Gilbert Gottfried, you've got to love him for it. He realized this seemed a little unhealthy. It didn't feel true to what their profession was, which is tackling difficult topics head on. So he made first a relatively safe 9/11 joke. Safe is, I guess, relative. But he said that he had to fly to Los Angeles the next day, but he had to make a stopover at the Empire State Building. And there were some groans, and then there were some boos, and then basically the audience just turned on him. It was just mass hysteria. Everybody hated Gilbert Gottfried at that moment. And so he had a choice.
Yeah.
At that moment, as a performer, you can do two things. You can walk off the stage or you can own the moment and just go for broke. And this is why you've got to love him, you know, regardless of how you feel about his jokes. You got to love his commitment that he went for broke. And he goes all in. And so he told the aristocrats joke.
Yeah.
And some people might have heard of the joke and some people might not have. There's no way I can share even a word of the joke on the air.
I think people may know of it. Let's just say it's the one of the dirtiest jokes around. And it's an old joke.
It is. And if it's not the dirtiest joke, it makes me really scared. There's a movie about it. If you're not offended, I urge you to see the movie called The Aristocrats, which is the punchline. And so he told that joke, which involves every possible horrendous thing in life. And at first, people weren't sure. But by the end of the joke, which lasts about 5 minutes, he had completely won over the audience. And these are very... I mean, these are professionals. These are people who do not just throw out laughs to be kind. And they were literally rolling on the floor. He had them won over. And so I think he made a statement with that. And there's a saying that if you want to make a point, tell a story. But if you want to make many points at once, tell a joke. And I think that's what Gottfried did that day, is he made a point that, hey, if we're joking about 9/11, we're not saying yay for terrorism or anything like that. We're confronting a very difficult emotional time. And you know, talking about or making jokes about things doesn't actually support them or doesn't say you like them. It just says you're confronting them. Mm. And I think this eventually won over his audience. And he's kind of known as a comedian's comedian for committing that night.
And I think commitment's the term, right? Because you say that's the thing that won the audience over, is he committed to it. And he was really walking without a net for a while there, but it worked.
He did. But then you need to consider, yes, commitment was absolutely essential for that. But then think, too, about Michael Richards. He's the actor who played Kramer.
Yeah.
And he is known now, unfortunately, for his racist rant that he gave during a stand-up once, that he was being heckled by some African-Americans in the audience, and for some reason he thought that was okay to throw out racial insults to them. Yeah. And you can look at that like, well, he committed then, too. The trick was, though, when he did that, he didn't convince people that he didn't actually feel that way,
right?
You know, that he wasn't actually saying, yay, racism or something like that, that he was trying to make a broader statement. The reason he failed and failed miserably is because he didn't convince anybody that he had more than one point. He he basically came across like he was making a single point, and it's a point no one wants to accept or
right.
believe.
Well, so does that say that in some way laughter or humor is it's a communal agreement that we all make in
it
some
is.
Way?
It is. Yeah, and it takes skill to do that because you need to be able to communicate many things with a joke. And that's why, you know, jokes that you can't see the person, you're not actually interacting with the person, they don't always go as well because, that communication can be complex and subtle.
You say to really understand all of this that we have to recognize the complexity of the human brain. So let's talk a little bit about that. What's going on in the brain when we're processing humor? Because you mentioned all the chemicals that are flooding our brain. Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a way, I guess it would be chaos in the sense that I think one of the unfortunate things about the way we look at the human brain is that we often compare it to the computer.
Yeah.
We say that there's input and then there's output. You know, we see things. That's how we take things in. And then output's the decisions we make. And there's memory. But the thing is, we do not have a central processor. Our brains don't work that way, which is good because computers break down all the time. When they get conflicting information, they don't know what to do. You basically turn your computer off and turn it on again and hope that it works. But we would not work well if that's how the brain operated. We can't just reboot. And so when we're confronted with a joke or something that makes us laugh, something we find humorous, essentially what's happening is we have a particular brain region called the anterior cingulate. Mm. It's a little below the surface, and it's essentially our conflict detector. So it's telling us, hey, you've got a lot of ideas going on here, and I don't know what to make of it. And you see it, you see the anterior cingulate active for a lot of different things, but almost always for situations when we're getting conflicting information. Many parts of our brain are interpreting what's happening in different ways. And so it's important to recognize the brain is not some very modular beast, I guess, that just works in a nice linear fashion. It argues all the time within itself to work things out. And that's what the anterior cingulate does. It works through that and it works through jokes. Mm. And that's why we find it pleasurable as the anterior cingulate likes making those decisions, resolving it, and then giving us a bit of pleasure in the end.
A bored mind is a humorless mind, is how you put it in the book.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. I mean, the brain needs exercising just like the body does. If we're not working our brain and we're not thinking and we're not just looking for new ways to expand ourselves and our minds, we're growing passive. And passive is not good in any aspect of our lives, physically or mentally.
It's interesting. You write about what's going on in the brains, for example, what happens to the brain when people who believe in God are thinking about God. And you say there's this conflict-reducing process that plays out. But you say the exact opposite is going on among atheists. When they think about God, their anterior cingulate activity increases. That's really interesting. Talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, I bring this up in the book because I wanted to point out that it's not like the anterior cingulate evolved just for humor.
Right.
It's much more complex than that. We're not so fortunate to have specific brain regions just for, here's our humor region. And so the anterior cingulate's involved in a lot of things. And a couple of those things are dealing with political views and religious views, which is really, to me, interesting because these are some major divides, unfortunately, in our population. And so, for example, let's do politics first. Studies show that people with liberal perspectives mm-hmm. tend to have larger anterior cingulates, while those with more conservative perspectives tend to have larger amygdala, which is a region I haven't talked about yet, but it's essentially an emotional center,
right,
which is also very important for jokes. These are definitely both regions that are active whenever we're processing humor. And so the amygdala deals with emotion, and it deals with also fear. That's a pretty big one for the amygdala. And so you could, and this is a little, you got to make some interpretations here, but you could say, well, it could be that when confronted with maybe a broad social issue or problem, liberals might look for things that don't make sense. What's the cognitive dissonance here? Mm-hmm. Whereas people more conservative-minded might think emotionally about it. And that's not bad or good on either count, because I would say that both are important ways of looking at whatever problem you're dealing with. And it But it is also good because if you're talking to somebody of a different persuasion than you are, it helps to kind of get maybe why, even though you may be thinking you're making your point, the other person might not be getting it because they're just talking a different language, maybe emotional or cognitive than you are.
You point out in the book, liberals and atheists, that doesn't mean they're wired to be more funny. It's just they're probably better at maybe at noticing conflict.
Yeah, yeah. And so getting to atheism and religion too, this is another really interesting area where the anterior cingulate gets in, is that when let me make sure I cite this right. When people who aren't – don't profess to be believers, when they talk about God, they feel that they get more activity in their anterior cingulate because for them it's a conflict-driven process. They're like, wait, I don't understand how – this passage of the New Testament matches with that passage or something like that. These are things that come to mind with someone who's not a believer. But if someone who is a believer, they show a decrease in anterior cingulate because for them, the idea of a higher power is something that resolves conflict rather than raises questions. And so, I mean, it's interesting because it shows how these two populations deal with issues too. And just maybe the right time is to – maybe the right thing is to ask questions sometimes. Maybe it's not sometimes. And this is how we look at life. And it's also just generally how we approach humor, too. There are times when we want humor and there are times when we don't. Hmm.
There's a lot of really interesting, I'd say, research related to humor. One of the most important of these in terms of discovery of humor comes from this experiment at Northwestern University. I wanted you to mention that, if you would.
Sure. Is this the Insight study you're talking about?
Yeah,
this is one of my favorites. It has to do with insight tasks are those that really require problem solving, but coming up with an answer very quickly and on the fly. So it's not a brute force thinking through kind of issue. So for insight tasks, these are the kind of things that we probably have heard of where let's say you have 9 dots on a sheet of paper and you've only got 4 lines to draw lines through all of those dots. Or there's something called the candle insight, Ducker insight task, where you are given a box of matches, a thumbtack, and candles. And your task is to attach the candles to the wall next to you. They're called insight tasks because they're not easily solvable. In fact, the answer almost always comes immediately, just without preparation or brute force thought. And so this Northwestern study found that being in a good mood, like being exposed to humor beforehand, improves your ability to solve these tasks. And that's interesting because other studies have shown that have actually done that experimentally, shown people things like Robin Williams stand up or Bill Cosby stand up, and then given them insight tasks to solve, and found that if you watch a comedy before trying to solve these tasks, you're twice as likely to be successful as if you watch something like a drama or a documentary.
That's Scott Weems. His book is called Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the neuroscientist Scott Weems. We're talking about his book, Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. Another question you get to, of course, is the big so what question. How can we use humor to better our lives? And you point out it's not a self-help book that you've written, but you do have these kind of practical ways of how humor can, in fact, affect our relationships, affect our health, and as you say, sort of the reference to what you said earlier there, make you smarter, or, you know, a better thinker in some ways. Let's start with this question about whether or not, in fact, humor is the best medicine. And we need to go to Norman Cousins because this is an important study, or at least anyway, an important story in all of this.
It is. Norman Cousins is a fascinating person. And his story began with developing a severe collagen disease. So essentially the material between his bones was disintegrating, which is apparently very painful and leads to usually death within a relative short amount of time. So he received this very difficult prognosis. And And then he also had a very unfortunate circumstance of while he was in the hospital being treated for it, he was just miserable. People were waking him up to take his blood and giving him bad food, and it was not a pleasant place to be. He didn't get much sleep. And so he realized, well, if being stressed out probably does not – if it hurts my disease, and it did, I mean, that's probably how he conducted it, or how he came down with the disease, as he was under a lot of stress at the time. And if it was hurting his recovery, then maybe the opposite could be true. And by laughing and surrounding himself by humor, he might be able to recover. And so that's essentially what he did. He checked himself into a hotel room and got a projector and just watched comedies and laughed and just forced himself to laugh for hours at a time. And it's amazing because soon after, he actually overcame this disease that doctors said that he could not overcome. And so you take an instance like that, and he wound up living over 26 more years, I think. And with pretty much full mobility, he had some – he was slowed down a little bit, but you know, he generally had a full and active life afterwards. And so you can take an instance like this and say, well, I definitely wouldn't say that people should not take penicillin or not follow general medical advice and just laugh. But I do think he did tap into something very important, which is we know that stress and negative emotions – lead to negative consequences for our body. And so there's no reason to believe that the opposite can't be true. And so anytime we're in a good mood, we adopt emotions like joy or happiness, and we laugh, we get some benefits and some very measurable and important benefits too.
You cite Howard Friedman's study at the University of California at Riverside. You want to talk about that one?
Sure. His was the longevity study.
Yeah.
Is that? Oh, yes. Howard Friedman's is interesting, and it's disappointing too. We know that there's a lot of health benefits to humor. It's good cardiovascular exercise. It boosts the immune system response. And so and it certainly helped Norman Cousins. And so Friedman did an interesting thing at University of California. He basically took a whole bunch of 11-year-olds, gave them personality tests. And then, and this is going to sound dark, he waited for them to die. He just followed them throughout their lives and waited to see how long their lives were, how healthy were they throughout their lives. And, I mean, it took 50-plus years to do this. It took a long time to follow these people. And in the end, he got some very interesting information that people who have healthy senses of humor, who score highly on sense of humor tests at an early age and keep that sense of humor throughout their lives, they don't live longer than everybody else, which surprised him. And it certainly surprised me that you would think that sense of humor, since we know it has a whole lot of benefits, would make us live longer. But actually, it's just the opposite, that these children lived shorter lives, not starkly shorter, but a little bit shorter with strong senses of humor. In fact, only one thing made you live longer, and it's conscientiousness. So that's a good argument for being nice to other people and just generally being a good person towards others. But sense of humor wasn't helpful. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason is that sense of humor is linked to a lot of other things. People who have good senses of humor, they drink more and they eat heartier. And sometimes they engage in activities that are fun but don't necessarily make us live longer, like skydiving or kayaking or things like that. So, I mean, I don't know if I want to live a longer life if it meant I had to give up things that I love. Fortunately, I don't smoke and drink in moderation. I think it's a good argument for both of those things. But in some ways, it shows how the trick of humor isn't like it's some panacea that's going to automatically make you live longer. You need to use it responsibly. So just like working the body, you exercise carefully, and that helps you live longer. I wouldn't advocate jogging in a smog-filled tunnel. So that would be bad. So you need to exercise your humor responsibly the same way you would exercise your body.
Did you ever have I wonder if humor stretches our minds, pushes our brains, is there any sense that humor could be a kind of treatment for certain conditions? I mean, Alzheimer's comes to mind, for example, or dementia anyway.
Yeah, I think it very well should be. There have been so many studies that have shown that any sort of deep cognitive activity helps stave off diseases like Alzheimer's. Things like doing crosswords, that is great, and that really helps you keep a mental fitness throughout older age. I don't know of any studies that have looked at humor specifically at that, but I suspect they must exist. Maybe they're in the process of being published now because it's a relatively new field. But I would absolutely say that humor is by making our minds active, is a great thing for keeping us engaged. And I think that's why you see such close relationships between sense of humor and intelligence. If you give someone a sense of humor test and an intelligence test, the relationship between your scores on those two things will probably be about as close as if you just gave two intelligence tests alone. So humor is as closely related to intelligence as many intelligence tests are to themselves, which is a great argument for watching funny movies, anything that kind of keeps your brain engaged. And it has to be a movie you enjoy, too. So I wouldn't say necessarily all stupid comedies are great. But one you enjoy that makes you laugh is probably a good thing.
Well, it goes back to something that you write about related to how humor works. And it relies on these certain stages. For example, for a joke to work, there has to be this, it seems like, this process that plays out. And you've got to have a kind of beginning, a middle, and an end, or a punchline is not going to work. So it's about context. It's about the way we follow a story. And it has to work for us. I mean, it has to be something we relate to, I suppose. So it's pretty complicated.
It is. I mean, going back to the Groucho Marx line, yesterday I shot an elephant to my pajamas. How it got in my pajamas, I'll never know. That's not many words. And just a short sentence, there's a lot of changes going on there.
Right.
And you think about the funny Jay Leno stand-up where he takes oddly worded newspaper headlines where there's a line where it says, a lawyer testifies in horse suit. That's a very short headline, but it might make you chuckle because there's two ways to interpret that sentence. And in a very rapid pace, and in just a few words, you change your image of what that lawyer is wearing, depending on how you interpret that sentence. And so I think that's also why humor needs to have a destination. That's why it's so healthy. So lawyer testifies in suit is equally ambiguous, but it's not as funny because it doesn't take you to that next step of imagining a lawyer in danger of being held in contempt of court for wearing a horse head and, a furry suit or something. You need to have a destination, which is why lawyer testifies in horse suit is much funnier. You can't just surprise people. You've got to give them a new place to go mentally.
You don't write a lot about this in your book, but I did wonder what you think – what's funny today, just generally, and I know the answer probably is, well, a lot of things to a lot of different kinds of people. But do you get a sense of where humor, not just in stand-up, but I would think of movies, I would think of sitcoms, for example, humor that you see on television or that you see on the internet, for that matter. Do you get a sense of where it's going? I mean, if we were to look at where Lenny Bruce was and that being a kind of transformational moment in terms of humor, do you get a sense of where we are now?
Yeah, I think our humor tastes now are very different than they were certainly during Lenny Bruce's time. But even 10 years ago, I'm thinking about when I was young, I was following people like Robin Williams and Howie Mandel. And these comedians were very over the top.
Yeah.
I mean, they were loud. They were fast. They were active. And then you think about who's kind of at the top of the game now in the humor world. And I think of Louis C.K.
Right.
and a few other comedians. He's probably – I'd put him at the top right
now.
And that's because his humor is a slower pace, but it's much more personal. And there's no ostentation there. There's no pretense. He's joking about – like he was on Saturday Night Live this past weekend.
Right.
And he was joking about how painful it is sometimes to sit through his daughter's plays and recitals. And you can tell there's a lot of – no one would say he doesn't love his daughter, but he's sharing something that we all get, that you can love someone and really find those 2 hours painful of sitting through that event because it might not be great art. And so I think his humor and that kind of humor is much more popular now because we don't like pretense and we want things to be personal. That's kind of where we are now in 2014. And who knows where things will be in 2020, but I can tell you I think – if you understand what the humor is like, you'll probably understand how society has changed too.
Well, that's what's so interesting about it is that it's a reflection. Again, it's this kind of organic, communal sort of response and tells us a lot. I mean, there's no great formula there, but it tells us a lot about what we're thinking about, where we are. And I wonder if in some way down the line we'll become less interested in the brutally honest kind of comedy of, you know, Louis C.K. or the personal comedy, and we'll go back to, you know, set up, punchline. I wonder if we'll go back, you know, if it works in a kind of a cycle in some way.
Yeah, I would say that's fully – I would fully expect that. And here I'm thinking of someone like Stephen Wright.
Yeah.
Who his comedy is like molasses. He throws the words out so slowly. But you laugh. And he gives like the Henny Youngman lines. Mm-hmm. Henny Youngman was famous back in the day for the take my wife, please, yeah, kind of line. You don't see that much now, but a few comedians can pull them off. And you know, like Stephen Wright's one of them. I think humor tastes shift like clothing tastes do, or any sort of style. It really just kind of reflects what we're looking for. And right now, it's always hard to define a time when you're in it. But right now, with rapid paced internet media exposure and Twitter and all these other instant sharing, we really don't like anything that comes across as, you know, look at me. Because everything is look at me now. So what's more valued is maybe what's called, you know, being real, being honest. And that's what we like now. But I fully expect that to change in maybe 10 years.
The idea of how you incorporate humor into your life, what are you thinking about in practical ways? You know, some people read a poem every week or something like that. Are you saying, you know, find something funny on a regular basis and put that in your life? Whatever you think it is that's funny, use it. Is that what you're saying?
It is. I mean, it's daunting sometimes thinking about comedy because you think, well, I want to learn to tell good jokes and I want to be funny. And I think it's important first to make the differentiation between appreciating humor and producing it.
Right.
I'll never be a writer for David Letterman, or I'll never be a professional comedian. I just know that's not my world. I have immense respect for the people who do. But I will always love going to movies that are funny, and I will always enjoy good, when it's done well on TV, good sitcoms and things like that. And the good news is that research tends to support that just exposure and comprehension of humor is enough. So it's actually not as good to just appreciate it and enjoy it and just watch it, you know, with mind turned off. It's good to take a joke and to try and understand, why is that funny to me? And even if it's going to be a very personal interpretation, so very often there might not be a right or wrong. But just thinking about humor a little bit more is enough to do things like make you smarter, make you healthier. And there was one great study where I forget the author who did it, but he showed people New Yorker cartoons without the caption and asked people, come up with the caption. And there was another one that basically had the New Yorker cartoons there with the caption there and explain, okay, what's going on in this joke?
Yeah.
And the people who got the jokes, people who could understand it, explain, and even those who could produce their own funny captions on the fly, these are the people who really get the benefits of humor. They have a close link between humor and intelligence. And I would say, I don't know if the study's been done, I would say they probably also are healthier too because their brains are more active. So whatever gets your brain going is a good thing.
You mentioned this I guess it was a study that found this in 1937, fewer than 1% of the respondents had admitted to having a below average sense of humor. 47 years later, a similar survey showed 6% of people admitted to being subpar in the funny department. And so you ask this question, are people getting funnier or are our self-concepts becoming slightly less diluted? Explain that.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, I think that's more of a rhetorical question because it has to be the second one.
Yeah.
Because you can't have only 1% or only 2% of the people below the mean.
Right.
It's just not that way. So, sorry, I know I'm 5'9", which puts me exactly at the mean as far as height. But, you know, if I were an eighth of an inch shorter, I would be on the lower half of things. And so, yeah, half of us have to be less funny than the mean. But none of us want to accept that. I mean, that's one of the worst things you can do is you never hear people say, oh, I have no sense of humor. I don't think anybody's ever said that to me. And it's because it's not something we want to admit. And frankly, I would say that's probably a good thing not to admit because, I mean, for take who we choose in our mates, mm-hmm. you know, what we look for in dating partners. When you ask women what's the number one thing they look for in a partner, sense of humor, number one.
Yeah.
Ask men, it's top three, sometimes below intelligence or good looks. So maybe we're more superficial, but it's always near the top. And so I would never go on a blind date or something like that and say, oh, yeah, I have no sense of humor, because it's not a sign of psychological fitness. It's not a sign that maybe you're going to pass on those good genes to your potential offspring. And so I think you see that in psychological tests when you ask people what they're looking for in a partner. And in fact, the only relationship in which women do not say that it's more important to be with a man who makes them laugh is platonic relationships. Relationships where you can't have children. So you can come up with evolutionary theories for that, maybe why that is, that if you want to show a fitness and a willingness for your potential partner to, you know, stick with you and show that you're worth the effort, you don't want to admit a lack of humor.
Yeah, it's an evolutionary trait, which gives us a sense that a sense of humor, it's if it's adaptive, it's going to stick around, I guess.
It is, and there's theories that, I mean, I'll get into it. It's always a little bit difficult making evolutionary theories for why a trait might appear, because, you know, you're looking at it after the fact. But the theory is that we look for humor in a partner because that shows a healthy mind, a mind willing to put in the work. And so that also comes up with some predictions too, because men, this is sad, but men don't necessarily have to commit for the long haul for raising children. They can make their contribution in a single evening or a single day, and then they're gone. So women need to be particularly careful in who they choose as a partner. They don't want someone who is not trustworthy, you know, not bright enough to help raise the child. And so that makes some predictions. One, it makes a prediction that women will look for men who make them laugh. That's key. And you do see that when you ask women, would you rather have a man who makes you laugh or who just laughs a lot? They look for the man who makes them laugh. Men look for women who laugh at their jokes, who find them funny. And you also see that too. For men, they like women who find them funny, who laugh a lot. And this is interesting because women do laugh much more than men. Put two women in a room, they'll laugh twice as much as two men. So maybe evolutionary speaking, the men are meant to be the clowns and the women are meant to be the audience. It's conjecture and of course oversimplifying things, but that's the theory.
Scott Weems. His book is called Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. He joined us from a studio in Little Rock, Arkansas. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.